Oh, I called the meeting to order. We don't have quite a quorum yet, but today we're going to hear from the legislative auditor and his report on the financial management of healthcare programs. We're going to start out with Mr. Nobles, and then I think we'll go to Mr. Alter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, and Mr. Chairman and members of the division, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor. And with me is Joel Alter, who is the manager of this evaluation. And I want to start, Mr. Chairman, by thanking you for giving us this opportunity to release our report here today. And thanking you, too, for your suggestion of this topic, as well as the suggestion that came from Representative Thiessen. I think it was important in getting the Legislative Audit Commission to select this topic. And you, of course, suggested that we pay particular attention to county-based purchasing, and we attempted to do that in this report. As all the members of this division know, we're dealing with expensive, important, and complicated programs in this report. And many other people are dealing with this topic as well, as you have over the years. And you are going to undoubtedly hear others who have, frankly, more dramatic suggestions and recommendations for change. But we didn't think that was quite within the scope of what we were asked to do. And I think we did what we set out to accomplish, and that is to assess these programs, their administration, and find opportunities for incremental change. And I think we did that. And I think it's important, as we talk about big dramatic change, that we not miss opportunities to make important incremental change. Even if it's small, if we do that 10 items a year, 20 the next year, I think we can move this system and make some significant improvements, both in terms of access, but as we focus here, particularly in terms of cost control. We found some things that we think the state can do better. And so we're interested in making a presentation of this report to you and hearing from you and your reaction to it. So with that, Mr. Chairman, again, I thank you, and I want to turn it over to Mr. Alter to make the presentation.
Thank you. Mr. Alter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Appreciate the chance to be here. My name is Joel Alter. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I also want to recognize, before we go further, the other two staff who worked on this project, Valerie Bombach and Tim Dykstall, and they may get called upon for questions later, too. Before I launch into the findings of the project, let me just say a little bit about where I want to go with our presentation today. I'd like to start out with just a little bit of background. Even though we have a committee full of people who know the healthcare programs pretty well, I think it's good to start with a little bit of context. And then I'd like to talk briefly about the state's cost containment efforts, and then offer some comments, some recommendations regarding both managed care and fee-for-service, and then conclude with some observations on county-based purchasing. Overall, our report does not suggest, as Jim said, we don't suggest scrapping the state's existing methods of purchasing health care and starting over. The general approaches that Minnesota uses are similar to those used by many, if not most, states, but we do think there's room for improvement to ensure that the state is getting good value for the money it spends. Also, we examine efforts to contain costs in publicly funded health care programs, including basic health care, long-term care, home and community-based services, and others. And we concluded that these efforts have had mixed results. And there is more work to do to ensure that Minnesota's already high costs for publicly funded health care services are not higher than necessary. Minnesota, as you know, has three main health care programs for low-income people: medical assistance, Minnesota Care, and general assistance medical care. And altogether, Minnesota spent about $6.5 billion for these programs last year. And a little more than half of that money came from the state. Medical assistance, which is Minnesota's version of the Medicaid program, is the biggest program, and it's not shown on this slide, but as you know, there are some sub-programs that are included in MA, things like the MSHO program, the Minnesota Senior Health Options Program. There's also the program that has just started recently, the Special Needs Basic Care Program for people with disabilities that are included in MA. The state's administrative costs aren't a large slice of Minnesota's $6.5 billion pie for publicly funded health care programs, But the dollar amounts of administrative spending are nonetheless quite significant. They include more than $100 million annually by DHS. They also include about $200 million annually by the health plans that administer public programs on behalf of the state. DHS uses two primary approaches to purchase health care and long-term care for low-income people, managed care and fee-for-service. Managed care typically means contracting with health plans and paying them a predetermined capitation payment, that is, an amount per enrollee for providing services. The health plans are responsible for expenditures that exceed the capitation payments, and the plans can keep portions of the payments that they don't spend. And presently, the Department of Human Services contracts with 6 health maintenance organizations, as well as 3 county-based purchasing organizations. And then under fee-for-service arrangements, thousands of health care providers around the state enroll with DHS to serve clients in public programs. When these providers deliver an authorized service to a public client, they submit a bill to DHS for payment. And so on this chart that you're looking at here, a couple things to note. First, managed care accounts for nearly two-thirds of the enrollees in Minnesota's Medicaid program, and that's what we're seeing here, Medicaid enrollees and expenditures. Like the nation as a whole, Minnesota has served an increasing share of its public clients in managed care over the past decade. The chart also shows that fee-for-service, at least as of 2006, accounted for a majority of the Medicaid spending for health care and long-term care. The reason for this is that a lot of the higher-cost enrollees, particularly people with disabilities, have tended to be served in fee-for-service care. Previous studies have indicated that Minnesota's Medicaid spending per enrollee is quite a bit higher than the national average, 40% to 50% by the accounts that we've seen. And part of the reason is that Minnesota has made policy choices to cover a wider array of services than some other states. For example, quite a few states' Medicaid programs don't cover things like chiropractor services or occupational and physical therapy, behavioral health, dentures. Those are things that Minnesota has chosen to cover that some other states have not. Also, compared with other states, relatively large shares of Minnesota's Medicaid spending go to high-cost individuals, people in long-term care and people with disabilities in particular. One of the ways that we assessed the state's financial management of health care was to examine the state's progress on previously identified cost containment strategies. And back in 2003, the legislature asked DHS to look at issues related to health care benefits coverage. And at that time, DHS had some discussions with legislators and suggested doing a broader level look at potential strategies for cost containment. And in fact, DHS hired a consultant and got quite a bit of input from other parties. The resulting report was issued in 2005, and it was sort of a blueprint for cost containment. It highlighted a variety of areas that DHS said hold significant promise for savings, and those included state-administered services as well as county-administered ones. We examined the status of the strategies that were identified in that report by DHS, and we concluded that the state's progress to date has been mixed. What I'd like to do is, without getting into a lot of detail on each of these individual strategies, is to give you at least kind of a snapshot in brief of some of these areas and areas where we think there's been more progress than others. Let me start with the areas where we think there's been some pretty significant progress. First, DHS has taken important steps to implement evidence-based decisions on benefits coverage. DHS hired a medical director probably a year and a half, close to 2 years ago. They created an advisory committee to help review coverage issues in high-cost areas. In the pharmacy area, DHS made several recommendations in the 2005 report to the legislature, ways to rein in costs, and for the most part, the legislature did not adopt those suggestions by DHS. However, DHS has taken actions on its own that have steered enrollees toward more cost-effective drugs, or in other ways, limited pharmacy spending. And then another area is that of electronic medical records, which is still clearly a work in progress, and in many ways, very early. But we think it's important that the legislature set an ambitious timeline for action in statute. The Department of Health has established a number of work groups that have been meeting regularly. There seems to be a lot of momentum behind this issue. Some areas where we categorize the progress as being moderate, one of them, people with chronic illnesses account for a disproportionate share of health care costs. Until recently, in the fee-for-service system, the care and the cost of this population were not very actively managed. During the past 2 years, the legislature has initiated programs aimed at care coordination with this population, and we think that's a good start. Likewise, DHS is in the early stages of implementing a new managed care program for people with disabilities. It provides basic health care as opposed to long-term care for that population. We know that there are some concerns about implementation of this program. We've heard it from some of the county officials and from disability advocates, and we think that it remains to be seen how adequately this program is implemented in practice, but essentially DHS has implemented the program as it said it would do in 2005. In the personal care attendant program, or the PCA program, the 2005 report by DHS proposed improvements in oversight and training, and DHS has made a good start in implementing a number of these improvements. But there are also lingering questions about the financial integrity of the PCA program. Finally, DHS's 2005 report suggested improved oversight of county performance, particularly in the area of home and community-based services. And we think DHS has taken, again, some worthwhile but initial steps in this direction that I could talk about if there are questions. Now, some areas with limited progress that are identified in the report. One is the area of disease management by health plans. Health plans that contract with the state are required to have disease management programs, and these are programs, let's say, for diabetes. In the 2005 report, DHS proposed to kind of step back and look at lessons learned from those programs that have been put in place by the health plans. And at this point, DHS hasn't done that. And I think that there remain questions about which programs that are in place are truly cost-effective. The 2005 report also emphasized the need for development of multi-county administrative agencies in small counties or a more regional approach. That hasn't happened. Also, DHS said there was a need to better focus its contracts with managed care organizations on a limited number of key performance goals. There has certainly been a lot of discussion about that between DHS and the health plans, but we think the actual progress has been pretty limited. In the area of case management for people in various waivered services, again, there have been several reports that have come out over the last few years that have helped to identify the problems, but as we talked with various people, including the disability community, the sense we got was that relatively few concrete steps have been taken to address the key problems identified in those reports. And then finally, DHS's 2005 report identified some specific pilot projects that it said might help to reduce Minnesota's reliance on nursing facilities, but DHS chose not to pursue those particular strategies. That gives you a quick overview. But in sum, I think what I take away from this is that the DHS report was a good starting point, but it needs more follow-through. And that's why what we recommend in our report is that DHS come back to you in 2009 and help you understand the status of efforts in a variety of these areas. If there are areas that were identified in 2005 where there have been some real cost savings, we'd like to see DHS help to give you some concrete data on what those savings have been and where they've shown up. If there are new or alternative ideas that DHS has in 2009 that maybe are better than the ideas they had in 2005, that would be an opportunity to put those on the table. But we think that the attempt made in 2005 was a good first start, but it just needs to be, there needs to be continued attention on some of these areas where there hasn't been enough progress to date. I'd like to next focus a little bit on the area of managed care, and specifically on costs in managed care. When we looked at Minnesota's managed care cost history over the period of 2000 to 2006, during that time, spending for medical costs grew at an annual rate of 19%, or at an annual rate of about 12% per enrollee. Meanwhile, health plans' administrative costs during that period grew at an annual rate of 14% annually, or at about 8% per enrollee. The cost during this period grew faster than enrollment, which is growing by 6% annually during that period. In addition to these trends, we also looked at the federal government's Medicaid cost database, and we were able to do some comparisons between Minnesota's growth in managed care cost per enrollee and the nation as a whole. And what we found was that Minnesota's spending per enrollee grew faster than that of the nation as a whole. Now, this is a six-year period we're looking at, and it's a little bit hard to isolate exactly what are the factors that are driving cost growth during this period. I should mention that one thing that happened was that we had the Minnesota Senior Health Options Program expand considerably and become a statewide program. And one of the things that came with that was an influx of new revenues, Medicare revenues, into this program that mesh with the Medicaid revenues that were here already. So some of this may reflect some new revenues that are coming into the system, but there is real cost growth here as well. And I think these costs, for that reason, bear watching in coming years. Now, some people point to managed care as a way to control health care costs, and we think it certainly has that potential, but we also suggest in this report that there are no guarantees. First, federal regulations used to require states to set their managed care rates at levels that would ensure that services did not cost more than comparable services would cost under the fee-for-service system. That requirement is no longer in place. Since 2003, states have been required to set their managed care rates at levels that are actuarially sound. That term is a little bit fuzzy. People are still figuring out exactly what that means. But actuaries generally go in now and look at the rates, and they usually look at past rates and the level of growth and trend those rates and apply those to future rates. And so there is some real concern out there that this approach of setting actuarially sound rates might also be inflationary. Second, there have been quite a few studies that have looked at managed care and what its impact has been on cost. The studies are certainly mixed. There are many studies out there that do suggest that managed care has led to cost savings over fee-for-service. There are competing studies out there that suggest either that there has been minimal impact or that even in some cases managed care has cost more. And I would also say there's been mixed evidence also on the studies of outcomes. Some that suggest that managed care has led to better outcomes, some that it's made little or no difference, and some that have actually said that it's led to worse outcomes. So there are a variety of studies out there on managed care that have not been completely definitive. And again, there's certainly reason for hope that, that managed care may contain costs, but again, no guarantees. Third, the ability of managed care to contain costs depends partly on whether DHS drives a hard bargain with the managed care plans that contract with the state. If DHS does not do so, then the health plans might keep savings that otherwise would accrue to the state. Now, in the most recent year for which we were able to look at data and look at the rates that DHS had set and the levels of income that the health plans received, the health plans didn't do great. They did have a positive net income in 2006, but it was a fairly small positive net income. If you look at prior years, generally we found that the health plans did better, and their returns often exceeded the targets that DHS had set during the rate-setting process. Finally, health plans' levels of capital reserves are one other way to look at cost containment, and certainly the levels of capital reserves have grown quite a bit in recent years. That's an indication that the health plans have been financially healthy for the most part. The question arises, did the reserves grow by too much? And that's a harder question to answer. Minnesota does not, and I should mention that we are not different from other states in this regard, we do not have upper limits on reserves. There are maybe only a couple of states that have tried to do that. And there's no real consensus opinion among experts as to exactly how much in terms of a level of reserves is enough or too much. Within managed care, we think there's a particular need for increased scrutiny of administrative spending. Now, it's true, as I pointed out earlier, that administrative spending is a relatively small fraction of that overall pie, but administrative costs, unlike medical costs, are subject to very minimal review, we found. Health plans reported administrative costs for public programs amounted to $200 million in 2006. Certainly not a small amount. I would also add that that is about 8% of the total revenues or expenditures of those plans. And that's one of the lower percentages of reported administrative costs that we've seen among other states that have managed care programs. Keep in mind, too, that that 8% includes some expenditures that are for premium taxes or surcharges that are levied on the managed care organization. Those amounted to about 1% of their total expenditures in 2006. So there are some things that they don't have direct control over that are part of that as well. During the managed care rate setting process, DHS makes assumptions about how much the health plans will spend on administration, but it doesn't actually set a cap on how much the health plans can spend. And we found that during the past 3 years, health plans spent about $50 million more for administration than DHS had assumed they would as part of the rate setting process. At the outset of our study, legislators asked questions about what level of oversight there is of administrative costs by various state agencies. And the answer is they receive very limited review. And what I'd like to do here is just walk through the three state agencies that have some responsibility for oversight of health plans and just say a little bit about the nature of their oversight of administrative spending. First, the Department of Human Services, which, as I said, manages the publicly funded health care programs and enters into the contracts with the health plans. I mentioned a minute ago that DHS doesn't actually limit the amount of spending of health plans for administrative purposes when it sets rates. Furthermore, DHS doesn't really look at administrative costs in detail. For example, it doesn't review subcategories of health plans' administrative spending. It looks really at just the aggregate level of spending. And it generally doesn't have information on the plan's subcontracts for services. The Department of Health has a role because it oversees financial management and quality assurance in the state's health plans. Due to staffing cutbacks in recent years, Health no longer has in-house staff to help it review health plan finances. And so Health has an agreement with the Department of Commerce to do this. That agreement doesn't always sort out real clearly what the respective roles of Health and Commerce will be, particularly as it relates to looking at the reasonableness of spending by the plans. The Department of Commerce takes what is really a very big picture look at the finances of health plans. It doesn't review individual programs, such as the public programs, apart from the overall business of the health plan. It doesn't generally look at individual subcategories of expenditures. State rules do require Health or Commerce to periodically, and by that I mean every 3 years, look at the reasonableness of health plan spending. But again, we found that that's done only at a very, very high level. Over the past 20 or so years that we've had managed care in Minnesota's public programs, there has not really been a definitive demonstration of the cost effectiveness of Minnesota's managed care programs compared with fee-for-service. But we do think that there are some practical advantages that managed care has had, and let me just walk through what some of those have been. First, we think the state's process for contracting with a limited number of health plans has at least provided the state with some leverage to get some improvements, whether it's in healthcare access or cost or quality or measurement. There is at least that leverage when you're dealing with a few plans and a contract every year. In contrast, it's harder for the state to have that kind of leverage when it deals with a wide variety of provider organizations in fee-for-service or with individual providers. Second, there is information on how the health plans in Minnesota are performing in serving the public clients. In contrast, in fee-for-service, we really have very limited information as a state on the performance of the fee-for-service providers. I should also mention that in terms of the health plan performance, generally when you look at things like enrollee satisfaction or comparison quality measures that are commonly used, generally Minnesota's health plans do reasonably well. Third, enrollees in managed care get more information than fee-for-service clients do on, for example, the services that they're eligible to receive. When there are problems that arise within managed care, generally the enrollees have more alternatives, whether it is going through an appeals process within the health plan or going to the state's ombudsman for managed care. Those are some alternatives that people on the fee-for-service side don't have. Fourth, managed care places limits on the state's financial risk, as I mentioned earlier, which can be an important thing. There have been times in the past before Minnesota relied on managed care when Minnesota regularly overspent budgets for fee-for-service. So I think that's not an unimportant advantage of managed care. And finally, it seemed to us that the efforts of health plans to actively engage members in health improvement activities was a contrast with the traditional approach in fee-for-service, where it frankly, to us and to many others, has been less coordinated and a little bit less proactive in trying to do some of the care management as well as cost management on that side of the system. Let me turn next to the recommendations we have in managed care. Again, overall, we think that Minnesota entered into managed care and its public programs with reasonable intentions. We think the resulting system has been good in a number of ways. Certainly the stability of the system, there have been some good things in terms of customer service, but we do have concerns, and we have the following recommendations. First, Minnesota's managed care system, as I said, has high and growing costs, and there's a need to monitor those costs more closely. DHS should, in our view, take the lead in scrutinizing administrative costs in the public programs. We think it needs to better define which administrative costs can be counted for rate setting purposes. It should also, in our view, consider caps or incentives for the purpose of holding down administrative costs. Also, I mentioned earlier that sometimes the health plans have done better than the DHS targets in terms of the level of income the health plans have achieved. Sometimes the plans have done worse as well. In the GAMC program, the health plans consistently, year after year, lose money in that program. And we think that DHS should come back to the legislature and provide some additional explanation to help legislators understand those deviations that have occurred between the health plan's actual earnings and the targets that have been set by DHS. Also, for rate-setting purposes, we recommend that DHS count health plan's interest income as a type of revenue. This generally has been excluded in the past. Also, to ensure consistency in health plan's reporting regarding costs, we think there should be clearer guidelines in how the plans must allocate costs, and this is how they allocate the costs between their commercial and public programs, but also how they allocate the costs among their public programs. There needs to be consistency in those practices, otherwise it can have a real impact on rate setting, and we think the Department of Health should provide that guidance. Also, we observe in the report that the Departments of Health and Human Services have both collected and reported information on health plans' performance levels, but they've used different methods to do this, and it's been quite confusing. We think that getting agreement on these methods is an important first step to getting agreement on how to improve performance, and we think those two agencies should get together to do that. Finally, some legislative recommendations. Earlier, we said the DHS should scrutinize health plan administrative costs more closely, but we also think the Departments of Health and Commerce could play stronger roles, too. Health and Commerce provide some of the data that DHS uses in its rate-setting process. Also, I mentioned that Health and Commerce both have a role in state rules in reviewing the reasonableness of health plan spending. So if the legislature wants greater assurance that administrative spending in the public programs is reasonable and accurately reported, then we think it's certainly within the legislature's purview to ask those two departments to play a stronger role than they're doing now. Also, information reported by the health plan to the Department of Health is presently classified as not public data, but interestingly, that data does not have that classification when the health plans report it to DHS. And the result is that DHS has been reluctant in some cases to ask for that information. We think DHS needs, as a part of rate setting and as a part of accountability, to have as much information as possible. And so we recommend extending that classification of the data to the health plan data that's reported to DHS. And finally, we think there are some intriguing alternatives out there to managed care, the reliance on kind of full-fledged managed care. For example, the possibility of directly contracting if the state were to directly contract with provider organizations and essentially bypass managed care organizations. We weren't convinced enough to make that a recommendation, but we think it has some potential. We think there are probably some pitfalls and some things that need discussion too along that route. And so we think that the legislature, if it decides to do that, should do so with caution, perhaps starting on a small scale if it wishes to go that route. Let me make a few recommendations on fee-for-service, and there are a couple of areas where we chose not to make recommendations because we thought that some of what the legislature has started in the last couple of years in this area are worth continuing and shouldn't be disrupted at this time. But a couple of areas that we thought the legislature should take some action. First, we think the legislature should consider modest increases in fee-for-service rates for primary care physicians. Today, physicians in Minnesota are reimbursed for about 30% of the cost of serving public program enrollees. About 15 years ago, that rate was about 60%. So we realize that at a time like this, it's hard to talk about anything that involves a higher level of spending. But we also think there is a fairness issue here, and particularly as the state begins to talk more about how it uses and relies on primary care physicians, we think this will be a continuing issue. We also point out in the report that a few years ago, the legislature required DHS to implement another approach to improving the fairness of physicians' reimbursement rates. It's something called a relative value payment system, and DHS was supposed to have that in place by 2007. That deadline was not met. We, in our discussions with DHS, didn't get any sense of when that might be in place. So we think we have a recommendation in the report essentially that DHS follow through and do what was required previously by the legislature. Third, we note in the report that we have a state ombudsman for managed care. Fee-for-service enrollees don't have a comparable advocate, and as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the people in fee-for-service are people with disabilities and people with complicated care situations, and we suggest that the legislature at least consider expanding the role of that managed care ombudsman, also perhaps making that ombudsman independent of DHS. Finally, I want to turn to one other area that is a way of providing and purchasing health care in Minnesota, and that is through county-based purchasing organizations. When the legislature decided to make the prepaid managed care program a statewide program in the mid-1990s, some counties were concerned about that and wondered, how are these private HMOs that are out there really going to be able to serve our rural counties? And so the legislature in 1997 authorized counties to establish county-based health plans. And today, and maybe you can see this in the map, we've got about a third of the counties in Minnesota that participate in county-based purchasing organizations. We've got in dark blue, Itasca Medical Care in northern Minnesota. In green, we've got South Country Health Alliance. And in red, Prime West. Those are the three county-based organizations in place today and that have been functioning for the last few years. These organizations have a lot of similarities to HMOs, but they're also a little bit different. They don't have to be licensed by the state. They don't have to pay the annual renewal fees that HMOs do. We found that these organizations have established some pretty good working relationships with the counties in which they operate. And I think the counties also see them as an important way of integrating basic health care with social services. And the counties have been very supportive of county-based purchasing as an alternative. We believe, based on our discussions and our research, that these organizations were set up for very legitimate reasons. But we also have some concerns that we raise in the report. First, we note that in aggregate, county-based purchasing organizations have had higher administrative costs per enrollee than have the HMOs. Maybe that reflects the fact that they've tended to be a little bit smaller, and there are some economies of scale in providing administrative services. Second, county-based purchasing organizations have somewhat different capital reserve requirements than do HMOs. Specifically, the county-based organizations are assumed to have the capacity to meet the state's reserve requirements because of their county's taxing authority. And we think that's a little bit risky, and frankly, DHS does from our discussions with them. We prefer to have, in a sense, money in the bank from these organizations to address potential fiscal problems as opposed to relying on just the hypothetical ability of the counties to raise that revenue. Third, there aren't many statutory restrictions on how county-based purchasing organizations can spend their revenues. There is one of the county-based organizations that a couple of years ago has started giving surplus revenues back to the member counties, and at least initially when it started doing that, there were relatively few strings attached to that in terms of how the counties could spend that money. We definitely heard concerns from people as we did our study about, you know, how are the counties spending that money, and I can certainly talk about that in more detail, but we point out that there really is not a lot in state law that places restrictions on that. County-based purchasing organizations don't have a real long track record, but we do point out that in these early years, there appears to be some room for improvement in their performance on some basic measures of service quality and also their compliance with state regulations. And finally, some counties have just one health plan that administers a given health care program, and that is allowed by federal regulations, and we certainly don't take issue with that. That may be a very appropriate way to provide services in rural Minnesota. We are concerned, however, that state law appears to lock in county-based purchasing organizations as the only plans that may administer programs in certain counties. So let me turn to the recommendations we have in that relate to county-based purchasing. Again, we think that county-based purchasing is an idea worth keeping. We think that there have been some growing pains, and that it should be evaluated over a longer period of time. But one of the changes that we suggest is that all health plans, whether they are county-based purchasing organizations or HMOs, should spend the money they get from public sources on health care, health-related activities. And we think that's something, it's not good enough for the health plans to decide that for themselves. That should be something that's specified in state law. Also, we think that any health plan that has a contract with the state should periodically undergo a review process, one in which potential competitors are invited to submit proposals. And at the end of that process, it may be that DHS arrives at the conclusion that, you know, county-based purchasing is the right thing for this set of counties. That may be the judgment they come to, but we think they should come to that at the end of an open and competitive process rather than having that be specified in law. Finally, we think the county should be held to a standard for reserve requirements that is more similar to what the HMOs are required to meet. Again, instead of relying on the ability of the counties to levy from their county tax bases, we think it would be better to have essentially money in the bank to deal with potential emergencies. In summary, as we said, we have not recommended turning the system upside down in terms of the way that Minnesota delivers services through its public programs. We don't think there's a need to abandon the private health plans or the public health plans or even fee-for-service, even though we think there are some limitations. But healthcare is a high-cost and high-impact area, and it deserves a lot of attention, and we think there's room for improvement. We think there's room for improvement in cost containment, in care management, in outcome measurement, and in customer service. And we think that those improvements apply to each of the systems that we looked at. And finally, even though administrative costs aren't the biggest part of the healthcare budget, we think there's a need for greater assurance that health plan costs in this area are both reasonable and accurately reported. That's the summary of our report, and we'll take questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles and Mr. Alter. I have a couple of questions, then we'll go around and let the senators as well have questions if they wish. On the actuarially sound, that means that the money that we give to the health plan should cover the cost that they have to pay to the providers, but it does not say anything about the fact that the providers aren't getting paid what it costs them to deliver that care.
Mr. Chair, I mean, it really doesn't address health plan payments to providers. It is intended to cover the health plan costs. And there are different ways to judge whether those costs have been covered, but you're right. That's the basic idea. That actuarially sound means that costs will be covered by the health plan.
And in slide, this is a different matter, but slide 8, which was DHS strategies, results are mixed. In terms of health plans and disease management programs, is that the disease management program run by the health plan and not by the providers, or are you looking at both of those?
Mr. Chairman, that's a good question because there has been debate about who should be doing disease management. Should it be the health plans and should it be the providers? And it's a debate that is not settled. Even within health plans, you'll find different practices in different health plans. Generally, what was proposed by DHS in 2005 was stepping back to look at the programs run by the health plans, because I think there is this requirement in the contract that each of the health plans have to have disease management programs. I'm sure there's additional learning that would be possible from looking at the experience of the providers as well, but that particular strategy that DHS suggested in 2005 was focused on saying, what have we learned from the programs that have been put in place by the plan?
Questions? Senator Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have at this time just a couple of questions. One of them relates to your suggestion that state agencies do not review administrative spending in detail for rate setting or accountability purposes. And we have tried in the past, it seems, and we've been met with some restraint saying that that's proprietary information, we don't have access to it. Are you suggesting that we can monitor this?
Mr. Alter,
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair and members, we think there's much more that DHS, as the contractor with these agencies, could do, both to collect information. Now, there is some information that's presently collected by the Department of Health that is proprietary, and if some of that is information that the DHS felt a need to get access to, there might have to be some tweaking of the statutes on that. But I do think that DHS, as the contracting agency, has every right to ask for additional information from the health plans about the nature of their administrative expenditures. So I wouldn't say that the statutes are limiting completely on that. I mean, I think there's certainly more that DHS could do within existing statutes to get information on the nature of the spending. I mean, for example, there is some of what the health plans spend money on is they can spend money on charitable purposes or make payments to foundations. DHS could collect information on the nature of those expenditures if there are questions that have come up. And I don't know that DHS has done that in the past, to look at that kind of spending in detail. But that's an example of something that's categorized as an administrative expense.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just expand on that a little bit, because I think, Senator Solon, if you're also referring to the fact that, for example, if the Department of Commerce were to seek that information from a provider, an insurance company, or whatever, that they would be blocked with the claim that this is proprietary information, I don't think that's a valid argument, because these are regulated industries which have to provide a great deal of proprietary information. It may need a classification, though, of not public, so that it is not generally distributed. But for the purpose of regulating these companies, they have to provide a good deal of information. So I think that's an argument that simply can be handled by an appropriate classification of the data.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Senator Solon.
I have one.
If I could just, we can't even find out what the health plans charge us to manage the health care for our state employees. Because that's considered proprietary. So we're supposed to oversee these health plans, and we don't know what we're paying. Senator Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other question, and you also said the legislature should limit expenditures from public funds to health-related activities for both the county-based plans and the HMOs, and last year we introduced legislation which didn't pass to limit the county-based plans from using the funds on other than health-related activities. But is there evidence that HMOs are also using it on other than health-related activities?
Mr. Chair, Senator Solon, the statutes that pertain to county-based purchasing organizations are especially broad and really don't have any particular restrictions. I would say that the HMO statutes are also broad, but it's I read them as being a little more implicit in saying that the expenditures have to be for health-related expenditures, but there are also, there's also some language that talks about, again, scientific, religious, charitable purposes. So there is a somewhat broader list of things in the statute, and that applies to HMOs in general. We're talking about the money that comes from the public programs, and what we're recommending is that to the extent that any health plan gets money for the public programs, that it should be spent for a health-related purpose. And frankly, we've had discussions with both the Association of Counties and Member Counties and the Council of Health Plans on this issue, and we haven't heard any great resistance. Now, they can certainly tell you directly what they think, but I mean, that's been an idea that, from our discussions with them, has seemed reasonable.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Nobles and Mr. Alter. Thank you for taking on a difficult challenge in which I know we had at least 25 questions you weren't able to address, even though you did a lot of work. So thank you for that. I have a number of questions about sort of the specifics, but I want to raise it up to a bigger issue that I think is actually more critical. And that is, I noticed in several places through the report and through your reporting, you noted areas where there's been clear legislative direction and yet the department hasn't followed through. And that to me raises real questions about, you know, the policy setting partnership between legislature via law and the agencies and their follow through. And would like to have, given that you've looked at all kinds of different agencies, all kinds of issues, give us some insights on how you think that evolves, and you know, is it more reporting requirements, more follow-up on our part to make sure that happens? For people who weren't paying as close attention, the ones that I noted was they did not provide the fee-for-service performance information required by the 2005 legislature. They didn't meet the relative value payment system requirements, which were supposed to be done by this year. My favorite irritation was when, in the midst of a major budget throw, DHS suggested to a conference committee that millions could be saved if we transferred the elderly waiver program from counties to HMOs, and they could take 10% off the top and totally disrupt the entire service system without any hearings, without any consideration of impact. And it was implemented because it brought money to the table at a tough time in a conference committee, and then within 6 months DHS declared they didn't need to take those savings out of the contracts, as it were. And so it just feels like those of us who sit around this policy setting table have a hard time having what we think we've arrived to it with an agreement, with a sign-on by the governor and the final law, actually getting follow-through. And I think that's a much more serious issue than some of the other ones raised here. And if you could give us any feedback, insights, how this balances with what you've seen in other agencies.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, let me touch on the couple areas that you mentioned. Obviously, healthcare is a big program, and there are a lot of things that the legislature asks of DHS. I have to say that we didn't see that there was widespread that there were widespread instances of DHS looking the other way when there were legislative mandates. There were certainly these couple of instances that you point to, which are important. And part of us pointing these out is we're kind of an extension of you and trying to tell you, here's what you asked for and here's what you didn't get. But I don't want to leave the impression either that DHS is simply not paying attention to the directives given by the legislature. I mean, I think we observed in many ways that they are, and that they are professional and competent in many of the things that they do in this area. Regarding these two particular things, and you've obviously read the report carefully in just the last hour here to pick up on a couple of these, but the one that I didn't even mention, which was performance reporting, the legislature asked DHS to provide, not only in the managed care area, but also in fee-for-service, some information at the provider level on what do we know about the performance, and using some general measures that are commonly used. And I know that DHS intends to do that. They have not done it for managed care, although my from my discussions with DHS, they plan to have something by spring. It was supposed to be done by last fall. And then they're going to turn their attention to fee-for-service and hope to do something there. You may want to talk more with DHS about the exact reasons why that didn't happen on the timetable that you set forth, but they are planning to do something there in the next year. In the area of the relative value payments, which is the fee-for-service payments to physicians, DHS, I think it was in late 2006, hired someone who was supposed to work on that and help to develop a value-based, a relative value system, and then that person left the agency. And so there have been some staffing issues there, but again, you may want to hear from DHS what their current plans are for that, because when we last talked with them, they couldn't give us really a timetable for when that might occur.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add, I would just echo part of what Mr. Alter said, and that is that we are an extension of you, and even though the legislature is very powerful in many ways, it has limitations, obviously, on what it can accomplish in terms of enforcement. We, too, as auditors, we can point things out, but we can't make people do things. I think one of the important things that should come out of this, frankly, is that you shouldn't just hear this from us. This should be an ongoing communication where you understand from DHS if they're having trouble implementing something that you've told them to do, why. And there may be reasons. There may be good reasons. But it ought not come to a come as a surprise to you that they're having difficulty. So I think some of this comes down to communication, because my experience is that even though the legislature certainly wants heed paid to what is in the law, you also understand the complications that occur and the limitations that occur. You just don't want to be blindsided. You want to know how the agency is approaching an issue that you've asked them to address, what problems they're having, and possibly what help or modification in the law they need. So I think that, more than anything, is the answer, is that this should not come as a surprise to you to read in an evaluation or audit report.
Other questions? Senator Sharon.
I have a few questions. May I ask several
sure.
questions? They're sort of in different aspects of the report that you made, so I'll be jumping through your report. I was wondering, could you tell me, one of the recommendations you made is that you thought there needed to be an increased oversight of the counties. Could you tell me what is the issue there and what specifically you're talking about in terms of oversight for counties?
Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, I assume you're talking about the county-based, some aspects of the county-based purchasing.
Yes.
The recommendations there, I mean, part of it is statutory things that we think need to happen as much as oversight, some clarification of some of the requirements that the county-based purchasing organizations operate under. We talked a minute ago about the issue of clarity about what county-based purchasing organizations can spend their dollars on. And, you know, we provide in the report, and I know there was a question actually that came up early in this process where legislators said to us, if you can actually tell us what the county-based organizations spend their money on, that would be great. And if you look in the report, and I'll see if I can find it in a quick second here, but on page 103, this was the one case where one of the county-based organizations had actually allocated money back to the counties. And so there's a breakdown, to the extent that we could provide it as of October of last year, on how the counties actually spent their money. So that's kind of our oversight. We're recommending that now there be some actual limitations in statute on expenditures, but I'm not sure there needs to be necessarily ongoing oversight per se of county-based organizations that's any different from what's applied to HMOs. Similarly, in the area of reserves, we suggest some legislative clarification that the county shouldn't be able to rely solely on their taxing authority. But that's, again, not so much one of recommending more oversight, but recommending a change in statute that would ensure that if there were to be an emergency in one of these relatively small county-based operations, that we could cover the expenditures. So I'm not sure that the general direction that we've gone is to say the county-based purchasing organizations need more oversight than HMOs, but we do think there's some clarity in the statute.
You spoke to two issues. One was the risk being covered by, you know, reserves, actually funded reserves rather than on cash. Is that something that would prohibit a county-based purchasing program from being developed or moving forward if they weren't able to cover the risk immediately and prohibit then the development of this? And then my second question is, how they spend their money on health-related activities. How are you defining that, and how is that, other than the charitable purposes, are you talking about limiting expenditures for those things that might support health status but not be traditionally seen as medical care, such as transportation or something that really keeps the person out of the health care delivery system at a more expensive level?
Senator Sharon, two good questions. On the first one, would this requirement that we recommend to have counties have essentially more money on hand to deal with emergencies, would that prohibit some county-based purchasing operations from starting up? I should say that right now I would say that at least a couple of the organizations could probably meet the current requirement that's in statute with reserves that they keep on hand. I mean, and frankly, from talking with them, that's part of why we didn't hear that this was a particularly onerous requirement for that reason. At least a couple of them, maybe all three, would meet that right now. But I think as we see a phase where there are going to be more proposals for new county-based purchasing organizations, and they may involve relatively small groups of counties. And so I think this is going to be an ongoing issue, and we just like to see more clarity. It may make it somewhat more difficult for the counties to start up, but I also think this is the kind of thing that could be phased in. It wouldn't have to be immediate. Mm-hmm. On the second question about how would the legislature define health-related purposes for clarifying what the expenditures could go toward? And I think that's really the devil's in the details there, because I think that county-based purchasing organizations see themselves as being that link between strict health care and social services, and counties want to see that linkage continue. And so I think there's room for debate and discussion about exactly what health-related expenditures could be, and we don't offer an absolute answer to that in this report. I hope that by putting in a table like the one on page 103, you can see kind of the range of possibilities. We've got some counties that have spent for things that you're going to look at on this list, and they are absolutely clearly health-related. You've got other cases where maybe counties, for some of the money that they spent, decided to use it to help balance their welfare budget. You know, does that meet what you as legislators expect? Or does that kind of stray from the purpose that you have in mind? You've got other examples in here. Here's a county that at least is going to consider grants for county jail inmates enrolling in college classes. That one seems clear that probably wouldn't meet a health-related purpose. But again, it's your call. I mean, I think this is a matter of discussion. And it's things like this chart here that can help you identify what might be reasonable boundaries for what's health-related.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alter, did you ever prepare a flow chart or any kind of chart to kind of take a look at what we as legislators have done in these programs over, let's say, the last more than 6 years? Because I think, you know, we have to take responsibility for us tweaking or adjusting or introducing some nuance. And I don't know how agencies, you know, frankly, I don't know how agencies can track us, you know, to implement something new that occurs in a legislative session when prior to that we did something else that may have, been an insurmountable task to accomplish. So did you make a flowchart, or is there anything we can refer to? Because I'd really like to track to see what we've done in the last 6 to 10 years.
Chair and Mr. Representative Erickson, if I had a flowchart of the changes that the legislature has contributed to, it would be about the size of this room, I think. But there clearly is a lot that health plans, that DHS have struggled with over the years, because as you know, this is an area where we have very large bills every year, and that require new things, and it is a source of frustration to, I can certainly say, the health plans, I think probably to the providers as well. So I think you're right. I mean, I don't have something to give you to kind of sort that all out, but I think it is a genuine issue and could very well contribute to some of the cost trends in administrative costs. There are more things that these entities have to do. But I would also say that in the big picture, probably the things that have mattered more have probably been federal changes, things like requiring performance improvement plans by each of the health plans. That's been a fairly big thing that's taken place over a number of years, but that we didn't used to have and that all the health plans have to do now. So I think there are certainly important changes that the legislature has imposed, but I would say probably at the federal level, those have driven costs as much as anything. The big things at the state level are probably new programs, the expansion of MCHO statewide, the development of new managed care options for people with disabilities, and those require a lot of planning and a lot of working out of implementation details that have undoubtedly driven some of the administrative costs.
Representative Rude.
And I apologize, I haven't looked at this report in detail. Thank you, it's very interesting. I have a question regarding slide number 10, when you it speaks to spending in Minnesota's managed care programs to increase. And I'm wondering, you have the total spending increasing 18.9%, and I know you have broken down administrative costs, 14.1%, but are you able to drill down and get the information as to where are those costs increasing? Is there a certain population? Are there certain diseases? It may be an obvious answer, I don't know, but is that information you have?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruce, this is about the level of detail that we have, and this comes off of essentially the financial statements that are reported at an aggregate level and that all the health plans have to report on. We do have some additional detail, I think, on some categories and what the trends have been, but one of the things that we look at in administrative costs is, in addition to the information that's reported on financial statements, there is separate information that the health plans report to the Department of Health that covers just their administrative spending. And we looked at that, and we talked, actually, as we went out and went to health plans, we quizzed them on areas where there appeared to be large increases or not so large increases. So we certainly have looked, and that information, by the way, is not public data, the Department of Health data. So there are some things that we could probably share with you, but this is probably a level at which the data are reliable and reasonably consistently reported, because it comes on their annual financial statements. And when you start drilling down, there's the potential for some differences in the way things are reported.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. Alter, I mean, the area that always intrigues me more than the administrative costs is the quality and what are we getting for our money beyond access. And you point out a number of places where that's an area where there's still lots of room for improvement and lots of things have been tried. But I'm wondering, as you looked at sort of what is out there, which is lots of different attempts at different things, did you see any evidence of the health plans being able to effectively use their purchasing power in the marketplace to influence provider decisions, outreach to particular clientele, really influencing sort of the delivery of care? Because we always get caught sort of in the middle of the providers say, oh, the health plans, you know, won't pay for this, and the health plans say, we really can't control the providers, we can just pay the price, and we're always trying to figure out whose reality is closer to the truth, but I suspect there's a variety of realities out there. But, you know, as you were kind of looking through all the various ways that have been attempted, did you see some that you think offer more promise? Because it looks to me like clearly we have a ways to go yet in that area.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, let me first start out with just a bit of context. I think that one of the messages of this report is that in the area of quality, we aren't doing badly in managed care. And if you look at Chapter 5, and for example, there's a table on page 79 that kind of gives you some idea of some of the types of measures that we as a state track, and that for the most part, our public, the health plans that we as a state contract with are more often than not meeting or exceeding the national averages in these areas. And you know, maybe that's a reflection of Minnesota having a relatively strong healthcare system in general. So I just want to point that out. I mean, I think that the general message of Chapter 5 is that on some of these types of quality measures or on measures of satisfaction, we're starting in a pretty good spot. We could be doing worse, even though there's room for improvement.
Representative Lopper.
Okay. Maybe you can clarify. I thought that for HEDIS measures, you only reported on people who are continuously enrolled, and I don't remember if it was 18 months or 24 months, which is not... I mean, our most serious cases go on and off. I think about half of the people in certain programs go off within a year program. So I'm not sure this is the only thing we should be looking at, but I think I'm right on that, aren't I?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leffler, I forget, too, the exact period of time, but you do have to have continuous enrollment for some period of time. And there are many limitations with the HEDIS measures. In some ways, you feel like you've just kind of scratched the surface, but this is kind of the gold standard as it exists within health plans. This is how plans do compare themselves. On your other question about what do we know about whether or not the plans have actually changed and improved service quality, and that's a harder question to answer, but I will say that, and I commented briefly on this in the presentation, there has been a certain level of frustration, I think, among the plans with the lack of what they perceive as focus in quality improvement areas, that each year the plans have to do quality improvement projects to comply with federal requirements, and the providers often, there may be different quality improvement projects that Medica is doing and that Blue Plus is doing and all the different health plans. So if you're a provider out there and you're dealing with all of those health plans, it's especially challenging, and I think that's been one of the issues, is that the providers feel like they can't really buy into any of these quality improvement efforts when they're so scattered. And that's a frustration we heard from providers as well as health plans, and I think DHS has heard that message too. But I think DHS and the plans are still struggling to arrive at a more focused agenda, but I don't have any magic evidence of things that have gone really well to move the system, but I think that has been a struggle.
Representative Lopper.
Follow-up to that, I'd say that our one of our healthcare reform work groups this summer recommended trying to, on a statewide basis, establish some general focus for quality improvement across all populations. I think in this area we're still going to need some special efforts for special populations, and the attempt there was to have the local public health agencies with the health plans agree on an area of emphasis in their region and work together on that, and I think that's had real mixed reviews as well. But I think that those are some legitimate concerns.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a couple comments on some of the discussion that's been going on in the last half an hour or so. I appreciate the comments about communication with DHS. I was listening to Representative Erickson, and while I think that the legislature needs to be mindful of what we're asking from DHS, I also think that it's important to let the public know that many of the recommendations that have come, DHS themselves has asked for it. And so while we get the credit for the change, it was initiated by the department themselves. In addition to that piece of it, we have, DHS has many quality staff that are in particular areas that are experts on just managed care alone, and that's all they do, or senior care, and that's all they do. And so that's one of the reasons why they're able to turn things around. And I don't say that for the committee, I really say that for the public, because I don't want the public thinking that we can be overreaching at times as the legislative body, but there is this working relationship, and it's a give and take on both sides. I also want to go to what Representative Ruth was talking about and some of what Senator Kretner Solon was talking about earlier. You know, and I appreciate the information that you were able to give, but there is still this piece because we constantly get into, especially when we start deciding how much money we're going to spend towards health care in our state-run programs in particular, this idea that the percentages are, you know, doubling more than it has and, whatever the rhetoric is. And it's often frustrating for myself, I will say, and other members that I've talked to, that it's hard to decide, are there more individuals getting on the program? Are the costs just higher? Or are the individuals that have been on the program and their diseases are they're becoming more challenging or more demanding, and because of that the cost has been risen? And so, not knowing which of those three categories, we constantly get in this political rhetoric around how much money the legislature is choosing to spend on these state-run programs. And you know, if it has to come down to more unified reporting, if we have to figure out how to demand more information from DHS to get that from the managed care, I think we need to be going in that direction, because I think it's also interesting that on many different areas over the years, DHS has talked to different members of us. When they think that we passed something that's not clear, they come back with a technical bill. Or if they think that we haven't done something correctly, they come back with a bill. They communicate with us on a way that we should be doing something differently even before we pass that legislation. But there are some extreme gaps where there has been some community, some public criticism, where DHS has not taken the lead or the role, I don't believe, to figure out how to close those gaps in communicating with us.
Other questions? Well, thank you, Mr. Nobles and Mr. Alter, for your excellent presentation, and I'll be up all night reading this. So, the meeting is adjourned.